appeals. We have two cases scheduled on the 1:30 docket this afternoon. We have counsel present and ready to proceed in People versus Davis and People versus Robb. Thank you. I think that all of you, all counsel, has received a set of our written instructions on our various procedures for oral argument. And I know we've got experienced counsel on both of these cases. Does anybody have any question about those procedures or the written instructions that you received? Okay. If not, then we'll get to oral argument right away on the Davis case first. Let me first remind counsel, when you come to the podium, if you would identify yourself by name and attorney registration number. And I'd ask anybody in the audience who has a cell phone or a pager or anything electronic like that, if you turn it off now so that counsel and the court aren't interrupted during oral argument. And with that, we're ready to hear argument in People versus Davis.
May it please the court. I'm Anthony Noble, registration number 33910, and I represent the appellant, Sean Davis. The central issue in this appeal is whether the criminal act is a continuous criminal act or whether it can be broken down into separate and distinct criminal acts. If it is a continuous criminal act, then we have a double jeopardy problem because Mr. Davis was punished for several criminal acts. If it can be broken down into distinct and separate criminal acts, then we have a unanimity problem because different jurors could have found Mr. Davis guilty of robbery under different criminal acts. I want to first deal with the double jeopardy issue because that was the first issue that I raised in my brief, and also we have some agreement with that with the people. The people agree that the two convictions for aggravated robbery should merge because they are based on different provisions in a statute that provide for alternative ways of proving the same offense. The people also agree that the two convictions for attempted aggravated robbery should merge for the same reason, that we have two convictions based on different provisions in the same statute to prove the same offense. Where we disagree is whether the conviction, the remaining conviction for aggravated robbery, should then merge with the remaining conviction for attempted aggravated robbery. To determine the answer to that question, we have to look at the evidence and then make a determination on whether the evidence shows one continuous criminal act or whether the evidence shows separate and distinct criminal acts.
Don't we first have to see whether or not statutorily it's the same offense, either as a unit of prosecution or as a lesser included offense, before we look to the distinct acts part?
That's one way to look at it, because there are, well, it is the same statute, but one is an attempt and then one is a completed aggravated robbery.
That's not the same statute. One's an inchoate crime, the other is a completed crime.
So if we look at the unit of prosecution, there are two ways of looking at the unit of prosecution, Your Honor. You know, one is to look at the statute and determine from the statute what the unit of prosecution is. And then the other way is to look at the evidence in the case and determine whether that evidence can be broken down into separate units of prosecution. The Colorado Supreme Court, or this court, or no court in this state, has determined what the unit of prosecution is for an aggravated robbery. There have been other cases looking at other statutes in which they've looked at similar statutes where you have different ways of completing the offense. For instance, in the burglary statute, the statute for sexual contact, and the Supreme Court has determined that the use of the disjunctive or in those statutes does separate the units of prosecution and provides alternate means of proving that offense. In this case, or when we look at the robbery statute, I think the unit of prosecution here is knowingly taking anything of value.
Let's assume we agree with you on that, counsel. How's that work for an attempted robbery, an attempted aggravated robbery? How's that play for the unit of prosecution? How does that work?
Well, Your Honor, an attempted robbery is a lesser-included offense. It's lesser-included within aggravated robbery. So to get, so the same unit of prosecution applies whether it's a completed robbery or whether it's an attempt, because the intent for the robbery is the taking or taking anything of value. It's the same unit of prosecution. In a completed robbery, it's an actual taking, whereas in an attempt, it's a substantial step towards taking anything of value.
And I take it the attempt here was the car.
Yes, Your Honor. That's the way that the prosecution presented the case, and that's the way that they drafted the complaints, that the actual robbery was taking of U.S. currency, and the attempted robbery was the attempt to take the car. So the question is does the evidence present one continuous criminal act, or can the evidence be determined to separate that act into distinct criminal acts?
Let me go back for a second. You said the completed robbery was the currency, but what about the keys?
Yes, Your Honor. The way that the prosecution presented it in the complaints and information was that the two counts of robbery, aggravated robbery, were taken of U.S. currency. But then during the trial, during the jury instruction conference, the prosecutor indicated that the jury could find taking of the money under one theory in the aggravated robbery statute, and then taking of the keys under a different theory. And also during closing argument, the prosecutor did indicate that the robbery could have been completed by either taking the money or taking the keys. So it's not really clear how the prosecution presented the case, because they presented it in both ways. And I think that when we take a closer look at their closing argument, the way that they did present it was as one continuous act, one criminal act. It was an attempt to take the car, but at the same time, the money was taken and the keys were taken. The way we determine whether or not...
Wouldn't the prosecution argue that no, the attempt to take the car was when we came back with the gas?
Yes, Your Honor. But they also argued that there was... The evidence and the way that they argue it could be construed that they argued it as an attempt to take the car in which money was taken. And the evidence that was presented by the victim in this case was that when Mr. Davis was knocking on the car window, he believed that Mr. Davis wanted to take the car, and he said something along the lines that he didn't want to lose his life for the sake of the car. So it was his belief that the car was the focus of the robbery. Also, when the victim gave a statement to the police, he gave a statement that Mr. Davis came into the car, he tried to start the car, it wouldn't start, then he took the money, which indicates that the intention was to take the car and not the money.
Did the prosecution ever argue that by taking the keys that was effectively taking the car, so you had a completed a robbery of the car as well?
Your Honor, I don't believe that argument was made at trial.
Thank you.
Did he try to start the car and take the key before he took the money, or did he take the money, then take the key and try to start the car?
Well, Your Honor, the evidence shows that it could have happened either way. There's testimony that says that he took the key first, tried to start the car wouldn't start, then he took the money. But there's also testimony that he took the money, and then, while he was waiting for his friend to turn up, that he then took the keys and tried to start the car. So the testimony shows that both ways. I'm not sure
Who testified that he took the key and tried to start the car before he took the money?
Sorry?
Who testified that he took the key and tried to start the car before he took the money?
Oh, the victim testified at trial that the money was taken first, and then he took the key and tried to start the car. But the victim's statement to the police was the opposite way around, that he took the keys first, tried to start the car, and then he took the money. And the officer that took that statement also testified at trial, so the jury had both versions of that fact. So the question here is whether what happened on during those 45 minutes was a single transaction or whether it was separate and discrete criminal acts. And the Colorado Supreme Court has said that the way we determine that is by looking at the time of the criminal acts, the location of the criminal acts, and the volition. What we have here is a criminal act that occurred within a 45-minute time period, essentially the same time period. It occurred at the same location. It occurred on the hard shoulder of I-25. And as far as the volition goes, I think that the evidence shows that the intention all along was to take the car. As I said, the victim testified that his initial impression was that Mr. Davis wanted the car. He didn't want to give up his life, you know, for the car. Then Mr. Davis got into the car, took the money. Or maybe he took the keys first, tried to start the car and it wouldn't start. And the way that the prosecution argued this case was that it was one continuous criminal act. During closing argument, the prosecution never broke down what was taken for what counts, for what robbery counts. The prosecutor did at one point say that the jury could find that the keys were taken or the money was taken. But the way that it was presented was as one criminal transaction. So on the facts of this case, it's much closer to the Woolhaff case from the Colorado Supreme Court, in which they couldn't separate the criminal acts into distinct criminal acts. It was one sexual offense. The other convictions had to be vacated. This is not like the Quintana case from the Colorado Supreme Court, in which the court was able to break down the criminal acts into separate criminal acts. In the Quintana case, there was a distinct break between the criminal acts. There was a touching that occurred in one place on one part of the body, and then there was a break until the defendant then touched the victim in another place, another location, and another part of the body. So the Colorado Supreme Court in that case was able to break down into distinct criminal acts. That's one thing the evidence doesn't show in this case. I think the only way that the evidence could show distinct criminal acts would be, for instance, that say that Mr. Davis got into the car, he took the money, and then he was about to leave the car, but before he opened the door, he decided that I want the car as well. I think that way, two distinct criminal acts could be shown. But that didn't occur here. What occurred here was an intention to take the car, he took the money, and then he continued with his intention to take the car. So the double jeopardy clause doesn't allow two punishments.
How can we tell there was an initial intention to take the car? The victim's perception?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that evidence of defendant's intent?
It's the only evidence that the jury had at that time.
Is that still evidence of the defendant's intent?
Yes, Your Honor, because from that testimony, the jury could infer what the defendant's intention was. So under that theory, the four convictions for aggravated robbery and attempted aggravated robbery did not survive double jeopardy scrutiny.
What are you left with then? If you're right, what are you left with then?
Well, the remedy in this case would be to remand the case to the district court, and then the trial judge will determine which one conviction remains and then resentence on that conviction.
What authority do you have that the trial court is to determine which conviction remains?
I did cite a case in my brief. I'm not sure what the case was. I think it may have been a case in the United States Supreme Court.
Why would the court resentence?
Sorry, Your Honor?
Why would the court resentence? He's already issued, he or she has already issued sentences for each of the crimes. Are you suggesting that there would be a whole new sentencing procedure then?
Yes, Your Honor, whenever a sentence is vacated, then there has to be a resentencing.
But why would you vacate the sentence on the conviction that remains?
That's the remedy that's been announced by the United States Supreme Court, and I think the case is United States versus Bell, that the case has to be remanded for vacation of the convictions and then resentencing on the remaining conviction. Unless the court has any further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Okay, you've got about 40 seconds
left.
Thank
you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Jonathan Farrow, registration number 35754 for the people. First, I'd like to address the issue of preservation on the double jeopardy claim. As the defendant points out in the reply brief, there does seem to be a facial split of authority in this court on whether or not it will review unpreserved double jeopardy claims for plain error, or will decline to address them at all. Yet I urge the court to actually look at the authority in these two lines of cases and trace it back as I did, because I believe that this division will conclude that the reasoning of the Cooper case and the cases that it relies on, as well as other cases from this court that have refused to address a double jeopardy claim for the first time on appeal, that this court will find that those are more persuasive and better reasoned cases. The reason for that is that they all tend to rely on what I call the Cagle line of cases. And that is that it's axiomatic that the court will not consider constitutional claims for the first time on appeal.
Don't we all the time consider constitutional issues for the first time on appeal, confrontation issues?
Sure, trial error type issues, yes.
Isn't that a constitutional issue?
In a way it is, yes. It just, I guess, yes. In the most general sense of the term, absolutely. But let's look at, for example, the Hinojosa-Mendoza case, since you mentioned confrontation. In that case, this court did examine some of the confrontation issues in that case, but yet it declined to address a constitutional challenge to the lab report statute itself.
Isn't there a difference between a facial challenge to the constitutionality of the statute and the constitutionality of an act or an occurrence
during
trial?
Absolutely, Judge. There are facial and as-applied challenges. Things like double jeopardy and equal protection certainly encompass both types of situations. And interestingly, the Cagle rule has been applied in both situations by this court and by the Colorado Supreme Court. I find it interesting that if you look at Cagle itself, it cites Rule 12b. But yet the rule has always been broader than the language of Rule 12b. Cagle also cites a couple of civil cases. And so on appearance, it would look like Cagle is the seminal case. It's the first case where this strict procedural bar has been applied in a criminal case. But that's actually not true either. Just in a very quick research, I found a 1935 Colorado Supreme Court case that was a criminal case in which they applied that rule. So this is a very, very old rule in this state. And for the most part, it has been consistently applied. Now, in this particular, excuse me.
Thank you, counsel.
Sure.
I appreciate it. You had said the Cagle rule has been applied by the Supreme Court in issues of constitutionality apart from challenges to statutes?
Well, I think in this case, we have both facial and as applied challenges
in double
jeopardy.
The Supreme Court applied Cagle to a constitutional issue that is not a facial challenge to the constitutionality of a statute.
I don't have a cite offhand, unfortunately.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel.
But I am very confident by that statement, and I believe that there are cases, not just in this court. Now, if you look at, on the other hand, the Flowers case that the defendant relies on, that case cites Miller, which is the very general preservation of error, plain error, harmless error case. It has nothing. It doesn't have anything to do with constitutional claims. There's also the Crothers case. That case does nothing more than cite the Olson case, The Olson case does nothing more than cite Grant, 1977, and this is where I find the root of the problem here. Grant cites a Colorado Supreme Court case called Archuleta, which applied plain error to a challenge to a jury instruction that had not been objected to at trial. So if we want to find where this started, this split, it happened in Grant when the division of this court took a plain error to a classic plain error situation, a instructional challenge, unpreserved, and applied it to this area that has been traditionally things that will not be reviewed for the first time on appeal. I'd also like to add that the federal courts are not unanimous in the defendant's favor, as he somewhat suggests in the reply brief. He is correct that the Tenth Circuit seems to be somewhat consistent on this, but I did a very quick research and found the cases in the Eighth and Sixth Circuits that seem to say that we won't review these claims. It's always a little complicated in federal courts with...
Those cases are in your brief, counsel?
No, they're not, Your Honor. They're in response to the cites in the reply brief.
And why are we talking about them if they've not been cited in a supplemental authority?
I have an obligation, I believe, on my client's behalf. But if the court chooses not to address them, I understand that. Thank you.
Do you think it's appropriate to be talking about cases that have been not cited to this court?
I do in this situation where in the reply brief that the defendant has brought in the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals and suggested that federal courts are controlling or persuasive authority in this situation.
Are you saying you had no opportunity to file a supplemental authority?
Not at all, Your Honor. And I'm not trying to make an issue of it. I apologize.
And I apologize for taking up your time, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you. Moving in for the sake of argument to the merits of the double jeopardy claims, the people are willing to agree that there should only be one attempted aggravated robbery and one completed aggravated robbery conviction in this case. That is, one attempted robbery of the car and one completed robbery of the money. Now, those two offenses, however, do not merge. Even if we were going to assume for the sake of argument that the unit of prosecution for burglary encompasses not just all things of value actually taken from a single victim in a single transaction, but also things that were attempted to be taken. Let's assume for the sake of argument that that's the case. Here we have factually distinct offenses. So this court doesn't even need to really address the more an interesting legal question, because here we have factually distinct offenses. And the evidence sufficiently supports that conclusion. And what's important here is the standard of review for this type of question. And the Mintz case is in the brief, and it's, I'd like to quote, when you're trying to determine whether the defendant's actions satisfy more than one unit of prosecution, the court looks to all the evidence introduced at trial to determine whether the evidence on which the jury relied for conviction was sufficient to support distinct and separate offenses. Now, what I take from that is essentially we're talking about the same type of review that an appellate court would do when looking at the sufficiency of the evidence. That is, it's basically a de novo review of the evidence, and the prosecution has afforded all favorable inferences. Now, is the defendant correct that there are other ways to look at the evidence in this case? Absolutely. Are there some of these theories more compelling than others? Absolutely. But the theory that I presented in this case, I believe, is supported by sufficient evidence in the record. And that is all that is required for this court to find factually distinct offenses that would allow us to have an attempted aggravated robbery conviction as well as a completed aggravated robbery conviction.
Is it your position that an attempted aggravated robbery is always going to be separate and distinct from a completed aggravated robbery?
I didn't express an opinion on that view, Judge Loeb. Today I would argue that, no, that's not necessarily true. Either way, I don't believe, I mean, as Judge Daly was talking about with the other counsel, Mr. Noble, about the Blogberger test and strict elements, I mean, clearly these are different offenses, and they, you know, we have a strict elements comparison would not solve this. I mean, well, it would solve it in the sense that they would not merge. So, you know, there is the possibility, and I take defense counsel to argue that the unit of prosecution for robbery as defined by the legislature in our state includes not just completed takings, but attempted takings.
Do you agree with that?
No, I don't agree with that. But, you know, I don't believe it needs to be decided in this case. You know, the problem with that is we have the Borghese case, honestly, which talks about what is the essence of a robbery conviction and what of the offense. And it's on the manner, the aggravated manner of the taking from a victim. It doesn't focus on the what's taken, the property. And we have the theft statute for property. So, you know, that's certainly one thing that would have to be considered as governing authority for this court. You know, I made the decision not to brief the issue because I'm confident here that we have factually distinct offenses.
Tell me how they're factually distinct other than the fact that he didn't physically take the car and he apparently did physically take the money and the keys. So other than that, we've got an attempt and a completed. What else is distinct about what happened here?
Well, if we look at all the facts in this case, I believe there's a strong inference, and really, I mean, it's sufficient to reach the conclusion that the defendant made a separate new volitional departure here when he decided to try to find gasoline and come back for the car. I mean, we have an abandoned vehicle in the middle of the night on Interstate 25 with the hazard lights flashing. Car stopped on the highway. You know, the defendant comes to the car window. He knocks on the glass. He wants to get inside. The victim says no, and I'm basing this on the victim's testimony at trial. That's where I'm basing this account. Victim says no, but he rolls down the window, and the defendant says, "Hey, you know what's going on?" And victim says, "I'm out of gas." Defendant says, "Oh, I can help you," but he pulls out a gun. He doesn't have a gas can, and so he then gets inside the car and immediately he pats the victim down and he takes his money, and then he says, "What's up with this car? What's going on?" And the defendant says, the victim says, "It's out of gas. I told you, you know, it's out of gas." It's like, "Come on, out of gas, really?" Start it up. So he turns it. You know, it won't crank. The defendant says, "I'll try that. Let me see this. Out of gas." He starts it. It doesn't start. "Oh, well, I've had my friend coming along in a few minutes. We're gonna get some gas for this car, actually. That's what we're going to do." So I think just the fact that we have this car, it's obviously stopped on the side of the road at an inopportune hour. The defendant has prearranged a pickup from an accomplice because he didn't call him. The assumption is that he knew the car. He never planned to drive away in that car at that moment. He had no idea what was wrong with that car. And the first thing he does is get cash.
How do you know he didn't plan to take the car?
You know, ultimately, I don't know.
When did he call his friend?
He did not call his friend, Judge.
Well, but when did he arrange for the friend to come pick him up? Was it before he got to the car?
It had to have been.
Okay, so he
absolutely
sees the car. I mean,
I think the inference in this record, and I'm trying to remember something specific for you, but I think what happened is the defendant and the accomplice were driving down the other side of the highway and saw this car. They stop on that side. The defendant gets out. There's an agreement probably made to loop around and come pick me up in a few minutes. Defendant runs across the median, and then suddenly he's there on the other side of the highway. And by the time the accomplice can loop around and come back to pick up his friend after obtaining some personal items of value, the defendant says, "Let's go get, we're going somewhere else. We're going to get some gas for this car." I mean, we're talking about going from a simple aggravated robbery of money from the person to a very more culpable, drawn-out kidnapping situation here.
So it's your position that because it's possible that he didn't intend to steal the car initially, therefore you've got two, and that it's possible that it occurred to him later on as a second impulse. That's your basis for saying these are two separate offenses?
I'm saying that view of the evidence is sufficient. That's supported by sufficient evidence. So it's not just possible.
It's an inference that one could draw, you're saying?
I'm saying it would be proven beyond a reasonable doubt that.
So an impulse that is distinct by seconds or minutes is sufficiently distinct for to bring something either outside the unit of prosecution or outside the pure lesser-included offense analysis?
Essentially. I mean, here we're not talking about seconds, we're talking about 10 minutes, but I'd like to give a quick analogy in the idea of aggravated robbery. So if I were to try to do an aggravated robbery and I use a weapon and I hold the gun up to your head and I say, give me your wallet, I want your wallet, I want your watch, I want your necklace. Well, that's multiple things of value, but that's one robbery.
What would happen if he would have turned the key in the car, would have started, and he drove away with it?
What would have happened? Yeah, well, he would have been charged probably with a completed robbery of the car.
Pardon?
Well, that would be a completed robbery of the car, I take it.
That's right, but there would be one aggravated robbery still, wouldn't there? There wouldn't be several aggravated robberies.
I'm not sure. Not necessarily. Again, I mean, if you take all the evidence in this case, this car is abandoned. He tells him he's out of gas. The decision to turn the key and not believe the victim.
Wait, I'll try for myself. You said the car was abandoned twice. The victim was in the car. How's it abandoned?
Okay, sorry. Thank you for correcting me. Abandoned in that it's not being operated at that instant out of gasoline.
Okay.
I see that my time has expired. If there are no further questions, I'd ask that this court affirm all of the defendant's convictions, and if it chooses to review the double jeopardy claims, we ask that this case be remanded, and the defendant seems to agree that he should be subject to resentencing. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Noble, you've got about 41 seconds.
The people argue that the correct standard of review here is the same standard that's applied in a sufficiency of the evidence review in the Court of Appeals. I would disagree with that because the Colorado Supreme Court has set forth the standard of review in this kind of case in both the Woolhaff decision and the Quintano decision. And in both of those decisions, the Colorado Supreme Court did not say or did not rule, for instance, that the evidence should be reviewed in the light most favorable to the prosecution. The Colorado Supreme Court set forth a test where this court should look at the time, the location, the volition, and then one of the other ways of reviewing the case is to look at how the people presented the case in the trial court. So that is the correct standard of review.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your time is up. Thank you to both counsel for your very helpful arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. And when counsel have...